Thanks for joining us, Stripe Show Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Fulton. Thank you for making us part of your day. Joining me, Scott Fawcett. I can see him as I look at my phone on Twitter. We're live.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly, but I can't see him on my computer screen. How about that? So that's kind of strange. But Scott, we've got a lot to talk about here. So let's get to it. The USGA and RNA have issued a statement, and we started to get the rumblings yesterday about this statement coming out about a potential bifurcation in rolling the ball back for professional golfers or elite golfers, not in particularly for the recreational game. And as expected, it's starting to get some blowback. And I'll just start with the first couple paragraphs from the statement from the USGA, and then we'll get into it and talk about it, debate it. I've got some things here that I've got questions that I'm not even sure they're probably fully capable of answering this as it's going to play out really over the next few years. They're looking at, you know, 2026 for this to play out. They're going to be getting some feedback, I'm sure, from the OEMs and professional golfers over the next handful of months. But the statement, the USGA and RNA have proposed a model local rule, they're calling MLR, that gives competition organizers the option to require use of golf balls that are tested under modified launch conditions to address the impacts of hitting distance in golf. The MLR is intended to use for use only in elite competitions, and this is key, if adopted, will have no impact on recreational golf. The proposal notice was sent to golf equipment manufacturers on March 13th, following the equipment rulesmaking procedures established by the governing bodies in 2011. Manufacturers and golf stakeholders can provide feedback until August 14th of this year. If adopted, the proposal would take effect, as I mentioned, January 1, 2026. So a lot to kind of digest there. You know, when it comes to this statement that's coming out, and we're going to get into other parts of the statement, but they're definitely putting a stake in the ground here, Scott, of, you know, saying, hey, we're looking at how far the golf ball's traveling, and we are prepared to govern and issue this MLR if you want to use it to roll back the golf ball. Your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts are, honestly, I don't think it's necessary, but I'm fine with a rollback for everyone. I just think the idea of bifurcation is where they just absolutely lose the plot here, because it's just rather than making a concrete decision of we're doing this, they're just kind of being wishy-washy with, and like, well, we kind of know we've got a problem, but let's don't rock the boat too much. Mm-hmm. So let's just make the most dedicated players be the only ones that have to face the decision of which ball to play. I mean, it's just, again, I've said for a number of years now, I just don't care about a rollback. I just think bifurcation is a terrible idea. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, I saw some statements from some equipment. Titleist was one of them. They talked about, you know, how one of the neat things with golf is, as an amateur, you can invest in the equipment, the same equipment that the players use. Now, we know that players are getting special treatment, and there's certain things happening there. But for all intents and purposes, the golf ball, I can buy the same golf ball that the players are buying. And when you do this, now you're really, you know, you're really splitting you're splitting that up now, right? I can't do what the players are doing. I can't buy the same golf ball. They're being treated differently. So that was one of the unique things in golf, and we're certainly going to lose some of that, aren't we?
Well, yeah. I mean, and golf really is. I mean, tennis, I guess, is in there to some extent, but like, golf is really kind of the only sport that you play that you also watch the professional version of. There's not a whole lot of people strapping on pads and going out and playing football on a weekly basis, or baseball or basketball. Golf is kind of the main, you know, mainstream sport that you really do go out and play often. And it's just, Yeah, I've never really, I'm not like a proponent of the argument of it's cool to play the same equipment the pros do. I mean, mainly because I've essentially been involved in professional golf my entire adult life. So I guess I just don't really see that. But I mean, again, I think one of the main issues that people, like the layperson, gets wrong out there when they just watch TV or they see how far the ball is going is they just think that distance is compounding to infinity, and it simply isn't. The smash factor, COR, whatever you want to call it, has been capped at 1.5, which I understand that's not the actual definition for anyone who's getting nitpicky at home. But like, essentially, you can't launch a ball at more than 1.5 times the club head speed.
Right.
And I've done this live on Twitter and Instagram before where I bought a 1999 Callaway Great Big Bertha and a 25-year-old solid core Strata and achieved 1.5 off of it. Mm-hmm. Literally, any increase in distance you have seen in the last 20 years, if you bought a new club and you're like, I picked up 20 yards, it's not because your new club is amazing. It's because your old club wasn't fit for you correctly. And so this just, I do believe that this just isn't a problem that's, again, is going to compound to where we get to seeing guys on tour hitting the ball 400 yards. I do think that about 195 miles an hour of ball speed is about the maximum usable. And after that, the shot pattern has just become too wide. And at some point, there is some sort of trouble out there. And then it's very difficult to shut your club head speed down for approach play. So, I mean, and again, I don't disagree. The ball goes really far in that.
Yeah. You know,
but scores simply aren't zero, especially right. In the amateur game. Again, now, if we even want to limit this thing to elite amateur golf, again, the only plausible argument you can make to me is trying to save some old golf courses from being obsolete. But my argument back to that is there simply aren't any old courses that already aren't in the rotation that A, want to be in the rotation for a U.S. Open or PGA, or B, have the infrastructure ability. Baltusrol being a perfect example of, yes, that place is, you know, capable of hosting a modern tour event, but they also have to put the grandstands on top of the 18th green of the upper course in order to do it. Every time that I used to get in these arguments with all the GCA historian type people, the argument would always be like, well, we want to see X course, you know, like name a course. And if 18 worked for grandstands and infrastructure, you didn't have to go but to 17 or 16 to show a hole where there's just not enough room for the fans that will attend a modern major. Like, it's just, it's an incomplete argument.
Yeah, I agree. And it makes me wonder, I've thought about this a lot this morning. You know, the PGA Tour is coming through the Florida swing right now. You think of PGA National, you think of Bay Hill, you think of TPC Sawgrass. I mean, those courses stood up pretty well. You know, I mean, they're not the longest courses out there on the PGA Tour, particularly TPC Sawgrass. They're just penalizing with rough and firm conditions. Now you get a little wind that plays into it in Florida. I mean, Copperhead. Yeah. I just think that overall, I wonder from a course standpoint, is this more of a major championship venue issue than it is a PGA Tour issue? Because I do think the PGA Tour does a really good job with course setup and sprinkling the tournaments around to different types of venues. And they can make the course play tough other than just adding 500 yards.
They do for sure. And the key to any of this is what you said earlier, wind. Like, wind is the factor, and you cannot control how much wind or rain you're going to get. So yeah, you can do all you can to get a course to play a certain way, but if you don't get the right weather on that given week, it's just going to play easy. That's just the way it is. We have just a modern athlete hitting the golf ball as far as we can. We've optimized launch conditions. We're optimizing strategy and everything else, obviously. There's just not, it's not the same game, and that's okay. You know, and I really want to make my point concrete about why I don't think bifurcation is a good alternative. So 3 years ago, I was out at the tour event in Phoenix, literally just a couple weeks before the pandemic shut everything down. And I was standing on the range, and I'm watching Kevin Chappell hit balls and talking with Mark Blackburn and Kevin's caddy. And Kevin has got on shorts and like mid, you know, knee socks and a flat bill hat and a hoodie. And he looked cool. I, as a 48-year-old, would have looked absurd in that outfit. But he looked cool. And when I turned around and I looked at the behind the ropes, there was 25 kids dressed exactly like Kevin was. And they could visualize themselves there. If I were sitting there in my khaki pants and blue shirt, or like Elkington used to wear the silky Bobby Jones, you just look like kind of a crusty, you know, older tour pro, and you don't resonate with the younger kids. And so the reason bifurcation, we need younger kids in the game. They are the future of the game. They are the future USGA executives. So having the game look more like them is a good thing. And so taking and artificially aging the tour, which is what will happen. I mean, if you're playing in the NCAAs, again, who knows where they're going to draw the line at what, you know, you start playing the tour ball. Maybe it's right. The NCAAs. I would certainly assume college would follow along. But so then you just keep pushing the decision younger and younger, because now the younger kid needs to start adjusting to the college ball before they get there. And what people miss in this argument is, like, they think that I'm acting like Colin Morikawa won't be able to break 80 when he switches golf balls. I'm not saying that. Like, they're still going to be great players, but it's going to take an adjustment period. And again, the concrete example of that is I entered Q school, whatever year it was, they switched the groove rule. So it was like 2010 or 11, I think. And I hadn't been playing professional golf all that year. And so I was just playing my old wedges. And I decided about 3 weeks before Q school to enter. I was playing pretty good, but I had to switch from the normal grooves to the new grooves. And I had, like, you know, basically 2 weeks to figure it out. And again, I'm not saying I couldn't hit the green with a wedge, but I had less control. I had less certainty in what kind of spin rates I was going to get from the fairway and rough. And so I was, again, penalized because I had not been preparing. But that's essentially what you're going to do to some player at some point who has to make the transition. They're going to be playing both balls. And so now you've got technically the least experienced player. That's not saying they're not as good, but they have the least experience. That's why they're the younger. And now you're making them make the decision of when to transition and then try to compete with the guys who've been playing it for, at some point, you know, however many years. And I just think that will artificially age the PGA Tour, which is going to get the Zalatoris, Morikawa, Matthew Wolf, DeChambeau, Maverick McNealy, Doc Redmond, just everything, Jordan, every one of these young players that's been crushing it for the last, you know, few years are a product of getting out of college at the NCAA championships, and they're teeing it up 3 days later on one of their seven sponsors invites at the Memorial. They just, there's not enough time with the new PGA Tour schedule to just figure it out until the tour championship in November. You have, like, basically 2 months.
Well, so on that note, because the PGA Tour doesn't have to adopt this rule, right? This is an option. This is the USGA that's going to put this out there. And for people watching this live, thank you for being here. You're watching Stripe Show Podcast, Travis Fulton with Scott Fawcett. And they don't have to adopt this rule. This is something that the USGA is going to put out there, and certainly that is going to be recommended, right? But the PGA Tour could look at this and say, no, it's not for us. And I'd be shocked. And maybe I'm wrong. We're in a different landscape perhaps in 3 years when we get to 2026. But considering where we are and all the discussion that we've had and the competition with LIV Golf and protecting of the superstars, right? The better players on the PGA Tour and all this money now being pushed their way. Well, one of the characteristics that all these players have, for the most part, Scott, is speed, right? Is length. I put out that tweet yesterday and just started listing, you know, Rory McIlroy's number one in driving distance. John Rahm's like number six. Scheffler's in the top 20. I mean, you just kind of go down the list and you just start checking off the names. Will Zalatoris, Victor Hovland, right? I mean, distance is a skill, creating speed and then being able to hit the center of the face, right? And be able to manage that speed. So
it is.
We know we're in the distance era.
Any sport is who is the biggest, strongest athlete that has the most control over whatever the ball of that sport is. That's who wins sports. Now, you cannot like that, but that is the definition of sports, the most powerful control over the ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's fair. And I think, and I agree with that. So on that line, right, and you look at how the decisions are making, I mean, I sent a tweet out this morning, you know, we wake up this morning and we have two professional tours playing in the United States this week, one in Tucson, one in Tampa. The PGA Tour has completely restructured how they operate. They've lost leverage to the best players in the world. They have to protect the best players and their sponsors. The official World Golf rankings, I think, is obsolete. And now here comes the USGA and the RNA. And yeah, oh, by the way, we're going to go ahead and roll the ball back. I mean, it's just like there's so much happening. And the PGA Tour, in saying all that, I'd just be surprised that these top players are going to want to sign up for this, right? Because that's what it's going to come down to.
So then let's pretend that that's the case. Then the inverse of it exists. It's still the same problem. Now the kid has been playing both balls, splitting his practice time so he can compete in the U.S. amateur. Because again, you have to have the world ranking, the Wagger points. I agree, the tour, the professional world ranking is becoming quickly obsolete. Yes. But the Wagger isn't. Now you need to be the guy that has that number one position. That number one position in PGA Tour University gets a card. Yes. So now they've been playing the rolled back ball, and now they've got to go start playing the juice ball again. Like the same conundrum exists. It's just the inverse of it.
I'm going to read a little bit more of this statement here. It says, golf balls that conform to the MLR, the model local rule, must not exceed the current overall distance standard limit of 317 yards at modified actual launch conditions with a clubhead speed of 127 miles an hour and based on a calibration setup of 11 degrees and 37 revolutions per second, which is basically 2,220 RPM. As part of this proposal, so they're testing it on 127 mile per hour club head speed with the limit of 317 yards. That seems pretty low to me, doesn't it? To you?
Well, so I just did a fitting literally yesterday for a driver, and this is the thing that just another issue with this is. We have a uniform ball. Like there's no way just a ball can be played by everyone because I mean, some people are different launch characters. A uniform ball would just coincidentally be optimized for somebody's swing and speed and be absolutely horrific for another person's. In my fitting yesterday, I was swinging. I think my average was like 124 or something like that. And my ball speed was 177, but there were multiple shots where I had ball speeds of 4 to 6 miles an hour less than my peak that actually went further because I just happened to hit the high knuckleball. And so how you optimize a ball across all different kind of swing characteristics without it just being specialized for one person. And then what we were talking about earlier, like if this is not proportional, meaning just a 10% flat rollback. So if I was hitting at 300, I'm hitting at 270. If I'm hitting at 270, I'm hitting at 27 yards less than that. Like that feels okay-ish, but that does not feel, because when you said the 127 for 317, like that's just not correct. I don't know how they came up with that number or how unoptimized spin and launch was to get to that number, but that is not an optimized 127 number.
No. That's the first thing I thought when I read this. Like, boy, that's not, I don't think that's optimized.
Close.
And so I've been scrolling through Twitter here, and thank you for people joining us here. And there's a few people that have made some comments. One of them, will a player's ball speed, this comes from Paul Enos, will a player ball speed of 180, let's see, for more distance with, will someone lose basically ball speed of 180 distance with rollback than a player with ball speed of 165? Is it proportional? You know, does someone who's creating more speed, have a bigger impact, you know, more distance that they're going to lose versus someone who's not creating that speed? I mean, how do you make that fair?
That is R&D. And so that's the main, you know, thing that people talk about on Twitter, which is funny because I agree with, like, making a golf ball is not expensive. It's kind of like making a pharmaceutical is not expensive. It's the R&D to get to the product that's expensive. Right. And elite amateurs, so we're going to basically incur double the cost to get these balls correct. And then obviously pros aren't going to pay for them. And there's only, you know, how many thousand, 10,000, 20,000, you know, elite amateurs that really try to qualify for the USGA type events around the world. Obviously we can't make golf balls exorbitantly expensive on them. So it is actually a legitimate concern. Who's paying for this R&D? I think the USGA is in a hell of a position to be able to be like, you know what, we're going to change some rules and y'all are going to pay for it. I mean, It's very bizarre.
So they make the statement that they're going to, let's say, manufacturers and golf stakeholders can provide feedback. Oh, you're going to get some feedback. I mean, you're going to get some feedback in droves here from the manufacturers, because this is going to be an expensive endeavor to get this right. I mean, how do you roll that ball backwards consistent for everyone? It's proportional. When you have different attack angles, spin rates, everything is a little different with all these players. And then how does that golf ball, how is that going to affect then the type of equipment that they're using, right? And the driver that they're going to be using, all the way down to the irons. I mean, everything has to change, I would to some degree. And I just don't know how you make it proportional. My mind is just not there from an OEM standpoint. I'm understanding that ball. Oh yeah, it's easy to do. We can make everybody incrementally come down, and this is how we do it.
At some point, we do run into the limits of physics. I mean, again, I'm not a physicist. I studied math in college. But at some point, you do run into physics. And that's a Marty Jurtson question. He's more of a clubhead guy. It's a Titleist, it's a ball R&D department question of how do you accomplish that? I'm sure they can get it close. But again, close just isn't good enough, because if somebody's optimizing for, you know, the balls just happen to be optimized for them, and they get an extra 15 yards just based on their characteristics versus what a faster guy would get proportionally, or I'll even play devil's advocate. It just happens to help a longer hitter more than it helps a shorter hitter. You just exasperated the problem. but when people, like, one of the main things you're seeing people ask for is, like, we just want a spinnier ball. A spinnier ball would make the game, if you don't like how I'm teaching everybody on tour to hit one shape over and over and over again right now, if you don't like that, if you make the ball spinnier, you're just going to make it worse, because double crosses and misses would become even more penalizing. You literally would make everybody finally accept what I'm trying to teach everybody. Like, dude, just hit the same shot over and over again. And if it doesn't fit the shot or the hole, choose a different club. You just make the problem worse.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, because your course management system, Decade Golf, is wildly successful, and you have so many top players using this. When you talk about at the elite level, your clients that you have, and I know you teach a lot of amateurs too, in mid handicaps and high handicaps, but you teach a lot of elite players. So I'm sure you're going to be having a lot of discussions with these players. But let's just say, Scott, for example, keep it simple. Let's just say everybody loses 15 yards. Okay. What changes? I mean, does anything change from a an advantage standpoint? I mean, all of a sudden now, Adam Shupak commented on my tweet. He said that the longer players would have more of an advantage, because they can reach the par fives. And then the shorter hitters losing that 15 yards, now more of them can't. And then my mind thinks, well, okay, well, if that's the case and I'm losing 15 yards, you know, do you buy into that all of a sudden now the longer hitter has more of an advantage?
I mean, if it's proportional, it would just, everything would stay the same.
Yeah.
Again, this is why I'm not against a general rollback. I don't care if you roll it back. I just think bifurcation is bad, because it just makes some segment of the population make a decision that puts them at an unfair, you know, uncompetitive advantage, whatever the heck I'm trying to say there. I don't think it would matter. I do think a spinnier ball could matter, because that would place a premium on hitting it good, which would then just exacerbate the problem, where the USGA says it undermines the core principle that a broad and balanced set of playing skills should remain the primary determinant of success in golf. If you made the ball spinnier, it would make ball striking all the more important, and chipping kind of all the easier, because it would just make it stop quicker. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, again, this is the other quote that I put up on Twitter was, the next paragraph in that same thing was, the goal is ensuring that distance did not become the predominant in the balance of skills required in golf. It's always been that. If there's any one thing that I think is hilarious that's based on, you know, Mark Brody's work with strokes gain and my work using strokes gain to solve course management is the idea that we needed data to illustrate that that distance matters as much as it does. And I am the poster boy of the guy that made this fallacy of, you know, whenever when I was in my 20s playing professional golf, I hit it past everybody. And when the new modern driver started coming out, I mishit the 46 inch one more than the 44 I was currently playing. So I just kept playing the 44. I never bothered to go out onto the course with it. I just kind of hit it on a range and it just doesn't feel good. And I would continue looking back at it. A, it didn't go much crookeder, but B, the mishits were going as far as my solid ones with my shorter driver. But every once in a while, you just happen to catch it in the middle of the face and it's an extra 20 yards. And 20 yards is, you know, a tenth to two tenths of a shot on every drive. Like, it's just that important. So if you're just hitting it further, it's just easier to shoot low numbers.
I just don't see the PGA Tour signing up for this. I just don't. I was seeing some tweets also that if the PGA Tour doesn't buy into this, then they, you know, now the gap between the PGA Tour and the USGA is even greater. I'm thinking to myself, I mean, we already know the four major championships are the biggest tournament and LIV's going to play. I get that. But I mean, you just look at how the PGA Tour leaned into all its stars, right? And their characteristics is distance. These stars aren't going to come to them and say, hey, man, let's roll it back because we're hitting it too far. Like, it's just not going to happen. And so, I mean, does a PGA Tour, can they just govern themselves with their old rules? Of course they can. Like, they don't need the USGA. So I just don't.
Does anyone, like, I'm not the guy that's championing we need a new governing body, but like,
yeah,
I do mean this.
I get it.
If you had locked me in a room and said, come up with 1 million ways to increase the, you know, to better the pace of play, I would have never come up with drop it from your knees or drop the time for a lost ball from 5 minutes to 3 minutes. Like, I wouldn't have even come up with those. And those are the two they chose. Like, they're the two dumbest things I can possibly imagine. And I just find it bizarre. And that's why I do say, I'm not like an elitist, like, if you're not good at golf, then I don't want to be your friend guy. But at the end of the day, a 10 handicap does not understand the game at the highest level. They just don't. I don't care how much they study it. They just don't. That's why I laugh at some of the mid single digit handicaps that are on Twitter that are offering all of this course management and swing advice and everything else. I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about unless you're just regurgitating someone else. The USGA just doesn't know what they're doing. And yes, there are obviously great players at the USGA. I'm fully aware of that, but they don't have the unilateral vote. It is a committee, and the committee on average is not great players.
And so let's say the PGA Tour doesn't sign up for this and they're like, yeah, we're good. We're going to govern, you know, we're good. We're just going to kind of keep things status quo. I mean, can you imagine like the PGA Tour signs up for it and LIV doesn't? Like, they can't, you know what I'm saying? That's going to be
if the PGA Tour said no, I would think that would put it dead in the water. I mean, I agree with you.
Yeah, like, because then it's now what, you know, yeah. Now what is your elite? Okay. So now you're going to do it all the USGA, championships. Like, you're going to do it at the U.S. Open, you're going to do it at the U.S. Junior, you're going to do it at the USAM, and I don't know. It just seems so clunky.
If the PGA Tour doesn't do it, college golf won't do it because of PGA Tour University.
Exactly.
So now it would only be the USGA events. That would make it dead in the water, or we would really learn how hard-headed the USGA officials are. That would be the biggest exclamation statement ever.
I just...
And I want to make it clear, I admittedly have a terrible history with USGA officials and USGA events, which is why I'm so cynical on them, because the stuff I've watched them do is just mind-bogglingly stupid once they start involving the local officials, which, again, they're trying their hardest, but it's just ridiculous how deep of lengths they go to make rulings so they can have had, like, I told you this is how it's going to go. That's why I cynically say it's a bunch of lawyers trying to feed their ego, because I've witnessed it. Some of the stuff they've done in USGA, like, not the qualifiers, actual USGA, the championships, where it's just like, you are literally just trying to insert your ego here. So you are right and I am wrong. And it's incredible.
There's a couple different things that I'll finish with here. One is there's so much great momentum right now in the game. People are playing it everywhere. Kids are getting into it. The golf at the collegiate level has never been better. I had JC Deacon on from University of Florida, and he's just talking and praising how elite it is right now, top to bottom. and then into obviously the mini tours and the Corn Ferry Tour and up to the PGA Tour. Like we get it, right? Participation is at an all-time high. People are taking lessons. People are buying equipment.
T-sheets
are packed. It's incredible. All this momentum. Now, in the professional game, it's a little sloppy with LIV Golf. I get it, but it's buzz. It's discussion. It's good for podcast business and this and that. It's a little fragmented, but this feels like we're going backwards to me. It feels like we're taking a step back. And that leaves a bad taste in my mouth. Why are we taking a step back with this? When I look at this and all this feedback that they're going to get from manufacturers and stakeholders, you can get all the feedback you want. I think if the PGA Tour elects not to do this, which I don't see them doing it, I don't know why they would, based off of what they've got going right now, it's just dead in the water. Then it just becomes, well, what was the purpose of it anyway? You know, and what is the real value here that the USGA is bringing to the table? You know what I'm saying? Like that's where it kind of all lines up for me with this. Can you imagine, like, look at the NFL, right? And I know golf's different and unique with all these department heads, but like you look at the NFL, can you imagine like there's a separate company running and putting the rules together, and like the NFL has to sign up for that, you know, like or Major League Baseball, or like
no,
you know, like they're governing themselves, they're running themselves, and I just it just feels confusing to me. You read it, it's confusing. What does it really mean in the end? And pointless. It just feels pointless and clunky, and like we're going backwards. And I hate that in a time that the game overall is excelling. It's really excelling. It's perception. I see it here, Scott, in my studio. I'm in Florida. I have an indoor golf studio. There's not many of these here in Florida. And it's taking off, right? I mean, people are interacting with this game, you know, with this way more than they did in the past. This is growing the game. This is getting people involved. I saw it at Players Championship just last week, that record crowds and people everywhere. So I just hate this coming down from the USGA right now. And it just feels like we're going backwards with this.
I think just because you bring up baseball, which obviously always makes me think of the one argument people make for bifurcation, like it works in baseball. And again, golf is just different than all other sports. And the reasons that it's different is what makes golf so great and unique. There is no defense in golf. There is no shared ball in golf. There's not even a mutual clock. The game ends, except for on LIV, at different times for everyone. Like, it's just a different sport, and that's okay. But as a result, you can't just say this works in another sport, so there's no reason it wouldn't work in golf. In baseball, if I don't even know when college players get drafted and when they start playing in the majors, but even if I get out and I have to switch from a metal bat to a wood bat, to be perfectly honest, I'm not really expected to hit the ball and play that often anyways, but I've also got an entirely another skill set of defense that I can play, that I can play at the exact same level I was playing in college. So it's just not the same argument. And I totally agree. The game, especially following COVID, I thought COVID was going to ruin the game for the first few months, and it has absolutely pushed the game. It might have been the lifeline that golf needed to really get back into the Tiger-ish era of exploding. Mm-hmm. And now it's a matter of keeping the people in, which is, again, as I've said, I'm fine for a general rollback, just not bifurcation. But the reason I do not think a general rollback would be a good idea is I remember whenever I was a kid trying to get it to where I'm hitting at 240, 250, 260, 280. And then all of a sudden, if you took me after 5 years of work and said, you're going to hit it 10% shorter, I would be like, screw you, man. And again, it's not like I would quit the game, but some percentage of the population would play less. That would not make anyone play more. And again, now if I were a golf course operator, I'd be like, hey, I really don't want anyone playing less. I like these full tee sheets. I'm getting to reinvest in some dated equipment and infrastructure in my clubhouse. And like,
yeah,
it's just a fixed cost business that you don't want to be destroying revenue for no reason.
Well, it's really timely that you just said that, because I've got a couple texts since we've been on air, and both of them are from really good amateur players that I teach. One is here in Florida and another one is in Northern Idaho. And I'll paraphrase a little bit, but basically both of these guys are saying the same thing to me. They're watching right now. They say the cost factor of buying and basically managing two different balls is going to be discouraged for them as scratch amateurs playing in club events and potential USGA elite events. It's discouraging. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of what you're saying, right? Like it just doesn't taste right, man. It doesn't feel right. It feels like we're going backwards. And again, I hate that.
Again, I don't want to play the conspiracy theory role here, but like the only legitimate argument is to save a few historic courses. And those are the exact rich, right, old white guy courses that the USGA executives are members at. I can totally see where they're getting pressure. Again, like I don't want to play the conspiracy theorist role, but I can totally see where it's like, we've got to save whatever course. I don't want to name one specifically and get banned from there permanently, but it just... I'm with you.
That's where my point earlier is this more of a venue issue for USGA facilities, right? Than it is PGA Tour facilities.
And I mean, that's a great way to look at it because they tend to play the more historic, classic-y old courses. I mean, it's a very valid point. Even in all the juniors and amateurs, I mean, they tend to play the older style course.
And so the cost there, right, because they don't have the room like Augusta, who could just buy land on 13 and lengthen that out. So the guys are more likely to hit the second shot off of that side hill. Like I get that. You know, I do think there is some of that.
Sure.
But you can't have it all, right? And I just think that when you add it all up, and the way that it's going to land, I see more downfall in this than upside. That's just my initial in thinking about this for the last 24 hours, which obviously will change as we get more information, but that's where I stand right now. Scott, we could talk forever. Fascinating discussion. Always enjoy listening to you. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on here on short notice. I can see you on Twitter, but not my computer screen. But I know what you look like, and I appreciate it.
I don't know what the heck's going on. So, yeah, I mean, I essentially, the nuts of the whole deal is I agree with you. That's why when you texted me this morning if I want to come on, I'm like, well, I didn't realize the statement was out. I had just woken up. And so I was like, I just really want to know information before I start talking to my butt. But based on what I've read, stupid.
Scott, appreciate it, buddy.
Appreciate you. Have a good one, buddy. Bye.